Please be seated. The court is ready to hear argument in 3209, Geodyne Energy Income Production Partnership, IE, versus the New Corporation.
May I please report, Ms. Cynthia Sims speaking in argument for petitioner.
May it please the court, we're here today talking about the Texas Securities Fraud Act. I'd like to address two issues. The first issue addresses the question of whether there is an element of transactional causation under the Texas Securities Fraud Act. And the second issue I'd like to address is the question of what it meant in this case to offer a quitclaim of an interest in an oil and gas lease. On the first question, it really comes down to the question of what does by means of mean. The Texas Securities Fraud Act requires a misrepresentation or omission. It requires that the misrepresentation or omission be material. And it also requires that the sale be by means of the material omission or misrepresentation. The statute could have stopped with the material misrepresentation or omission, but it didn't. It has those other words, by means of. Now, what does that mean? It seems to me that by means of creates some sort of link. It creates a bridge between the material misrepresentation and the sale. And what exactly that would be has been addressed in some of the federal courts that have addressed the issue under the federal securities law 12-2. And in particular, what those courts have said is that the causation is not proximate cause. I don't think it's the equivalent even of our producing cause. But there must be a link. The material misrepresentation must have been a instrumental in effecting the sale. It must have been instrumental in bringing the sale about, even if it's not decisive. It must have been a part of that process.
Can you give an example of that? When would something be by means of but not proximate cause?
I think it's something in which it would be, a proximate cause would be, it requires foreseeability.
I know what proximate cause is, but I have no idea what means by means of but not proximate cause.
All right. Maybe you've written something in there and you don't realize that this would cause people to do something, but it is not accurate. That would be one thing. It could be that there is a bundle of things.
So did you just said if there's any inaccuracy in there?
Well, for example, the amicus brief points to. I disagree with that. This would always end up in being able to rescind a transaction, but a biographical error. He points to that as saying that if you have an error in your biography, in your prospectus, then that can lead to rescission in and of itself. And so an error in a biography in your prospectus may be something that, you know, is not foreseeable. Maybe people, the average person doesn't care that you went to the University of Oklahoma as opposed to Harvard, or that you have some sort of record that should be in your biography that may affect the decision. But this causation does get subjective, like most causation. It does ask the question of what was in your mind when you bid on this transaction or when you bought this interest. But it may be something that's not quite material.
No, my understanding of the federal securities law is if you put something in a prospectus that misleads the market so the price is higher, but I personally never read the prospectus. Nevertheless, because the market's higher, because other people were misled, I never relied, but it did have an effect on me even though I never saw it.
Yes. That's a fraud on the market theory. That's the Sanders versus Nuveen case.
And so that would certainly be a but-for. By means of.
It was a material misrepresentation that affected the entire market. And the problem in Sanders versus Nuveen, and the Seventh Circuit struggled with that case because they wanted to satisfy the standard that had been put out by the Second Circuit that it was instrumental in bringing about the sale, while still saying not everybody in the world has to sit down and read the prospectus. And that's what gave rise to the fraud of the market theory that's recognized in some jurisdictions but not in others. But the theory is some people read the prospectus, and it drove up the price, and the price that was elevated affected the entire market. And so they allowed that to be the causation. The Second Circuit, as I've mentioned, has adopted that standard. So have at least other circuits have looked to that standard and incorporated it in their reasoning. The Eighth Circuit has. The Third Circuit's mentioned it. The Tenth Circuit.
The amicus brief says it's only the Second Circuit. You disagree with that?
I absolutely disagree with that. And the amicus brief tends to overlook authorities that don't agree with the view of the amicus brief. And there's a lot of other authorities out there. In fact, if you read the authorities in the amicus brief pretty carefully, some of those authorities actually are ones that I probably should have cited in my brief. They support our position. The amicus brief also, actually, the Court of Appeals said that it should only be an in connection with test. And that's, I think, what Newton has argued for. And the amicus brief also argues for that. The reasoning set forth in the amicus brief is very interesting and, I think, very persuasive for the fact that it should not be an in connection with test. What the amicus brief says is you should look to 10b-5. It uses in connection with. And so you should use that same sort of standard over here. The problem is 10b-5 uses that language. It says in connection with, while in 12.2, the language is different. It says by means of. So we know Congress knew to use that language. It was capable of using that language. It did use that language elsewhere in the Securities Act, and yet it chose to use different language in 12.2. So it must mean something, and it must mean something other than in connection with. And I don't think there's a better authority out there, a better explanation of what it should mean other than the Second Circuit Jackson.
I'm a little bit confused at where this all fits. Apparently, the jury found an omission rather than a false statement. Would you say that's right? Or they could have found.
They could have found an omission.
And that would be based on the failure to produce the joint interest billing statements?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So why can't you then read the statute to say, by means of the person who offered it or sold it by means of omitting? Why doesn't it just fit the literal wording of the statute? Because it seems to me the argument is, if we had had that information, we wouldn't have bought. So there is sort of a reliance piece under the literal wording of the statute.
I agree that the literal wording of the statute absolutely supports that there is a causal link.
And so why are we arguing whether one's necessary or not? I mean, I hear the argument is, do we have to establish causation or not? But it seems like under the facts of this case and the literal wording of the statute, that's not really in dispute here. That the purchase was made by means of an omission is the allegation. So this theoretical inquiry about causation reliance, what it might or might not be, is not presented so much on the facts of this case.
If the point of that is that this court can decide this case on something other than causation, I agree with that. It seems to me that there are, reading all of the briefs, reading the opinion of the Court of Appeals, that there are two arguments being made by Newton. One is the omission argument. If you had given me the joint interest billing statements, I would have seen that there were no workovers. And I would have known that with zero production and no workovers, I would not have bought this property. The problem with that, and that one to me, you can easily decide it on the materiality decision. because what they had before them was a chart and covered 6 months of time, and it showed production and it showed expenses in about 10, 12 different categories. And the production was zero or next to zero. And then all of the production or all of the expense categories were zero except for miscellaneous expenses. And there is a specific expense category for workovers. And it has a string of zeros on that category for 6 months. I don't know what you could have seen in the joint billing statements that would have made this well look worse than how it already appeared on that piece of paper. Because they need to come in here and say, wow, the piece of paper looked okay, but if I had seen the joint billing statements, I would have known not to bid.
And I understand that argument. But where do we get into having to define what causation looks like in this case?
It seems to me that if you get past the misrepresentation or the omission, and you find that the omission may or may not have been material, then you get into causation. And where causation would come into play would be with regard to the actions that were taken with respect to those things, and it would also come into play, and this may be important, in the context of oil and gas industry auctions.
Okay, and I understand the argument on that piece, but I'm still confused on...
That where it would come into play would be with regard to how you get into the auction, in that you have to sign all of these forms. You have to say you're sophisticated, that you are, you know, having no representations, no warranties, and all of those things that you sign in order to get in.
It would be the interaction of the as-is clause.
As-is, but that's just one of many. I mean, it is a long string of things in which you, the buyer, generally take over to do the due diligence. And courts, the other courts that have dealt with that issue in the federal area, have dealt with that issue usually with regard to the reliance requirement, say under 10b-5, and it would feed into causation here.
Why is it you say this is a quit claim?
Yes, this is a quit claim transaction. Because the instrument is exactly as described in Rogers versus Ricane, this court's opinion.
No.
It's a right title and
I'm just flipping through here. I can't see quit claim. Which document am I looking for, and where does it say quit claim?
I think it would be in Volume 8, Plaintiff's Exhibit 40. And it is not titled quit claim. It is titled Assignment and Bill of Sale. And if you look at the language that comes after that, it's without warranty, and it consistently says that we are conveying our right, title, and interest. And that is typical quit claim language. To get back to your point for just a second, this state and this has a little bit of a problem in that I think I sent a letter here. It was a paper written for the Panhandle Producers Pipeline Group. And it says very clearly at the end of the discussion that what this case means is that no matter what you've signed, no matter what you've said, no matter what promises you've made going into these auctions, you do not have to do any due diligence. All you need is a misrepresentation that's material, and then you get to back out of the deal. That same discussion, that same author over the summer, wrote the update for the SMU Law Journal discussion of oil and gas. That same discussion, that almost identical paragraph, now appears in the SMU Law Journal. And so what you have is a problem that's going to be endemic in these auctions of people thinking, maybe I don't have to do due diligence.
Is there any reason for us to look at the fact that, you know, just as it happens, Judah has sold nothing at the auction. So they walk in and they get to that, and apparently under your theory, they'd have no duty to investigate whether they actually own the interest that they're putting up on the auction block. And it seems like there's something wrong about that in the law, and maybe in the statute. But
I think what you have to look at is the very nature of what it was that we put up for auction. We were not selling a warranted piece of property. We were quit claiming our interest, whatever it may be. And That is the very essence of what a quitclaim is. And it happens all the time that people will quitclaim properties not really knowing whether they own anything. And quitclaims are very important. They are used to clear title, and they have an important function. But in this auction, the reason that there was no misrepresentation was that you have to look at what it was that was being conveyed or what was being sold. And it was strictly our interest in the property, whatever that interest may have been.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May I please report, Mr. Jeff King?
Thank you. May it please the court, Jeff King here, confusion list. Your Honor, I would like to answer your question, Justice O'Neill, concerning what the misrepresentation was before I get into my argument. There was an omission case, and it was a direct misrepresentation case. In this instance, they represented that there was an oil and gas lease. That representation turned out to be wrong. The oil and gas lease had terminated more than a year prior to the sale in this transaction.
Was there any evidence they knew that? What's the evidence they knew that?
The evidence is there is no evidence that they knew that, but under the statute, they did not prove that they, after exercising reasonable diligence, were unable to know.
There's evidence they should have known that.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But when they come in and sell their right, title, and interest to the leases attached, negligently not knowing that they no longer have, I mean, people negligently sell whatever right they have when they arguably should have known better all the time, right?
Yes.
So why is this in this case that going to be a material omission?
Because we go into the Texas Securities Act, and the Texas Securities Act requires disclosure on behalf of the seller.
But I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but misrepresentation is not really an issue. Because, I mean, the jury found no misrepresentation, so we really are talking about an omission.
The jury found a violation of the Texas Securities Act, and the instruction to the jury was that there was a material misrepresentation.
An untrue statement of material fact. The prior question said on the fraudulent inducement claim that there must be a false representation. They found no. So isn't that kind of inconsistent with it?
No, because in the fraudulent inducement case, they had to also find intent. And what the jury found was that there was not an intentional misrepresentation. So I don't think you can equate the fraudulent inducement answer with the fact that there was no misrepresentation. They found that there was an intentional misrepresentation. Your Honor, hopefully I can get back to your question. But the Securities Act requires disclosure. It is a seller integrity statute. And it's modeled after Section 12.2, and it's modeled after the Uniform Securities Act that most of our states have passed. And in every one of those instances, the purpose behind those statutes was to require disclosure. And it provides defenses for sellers, and those defenses are, well, if the defendant actually knew, not constructively knew, but actually knew that the statements were false, then there's no liability. Or secondly, after exercising reasonable care, the other side could not, or the seller could not have known. And in this case, the evidence is, and in this really, they say that it was rebutted, but I didn't read it. I tried the case myself at the trial court. The evidence was, from the only expert that was there, was that all of the information that Geodyne was receiving, you know, was that this lease had terminated, and it had terminated quite some time before. Much of that information, the JIBs, the joint interest billings, which in the records, that thick.
But the chart showed the same thing, didn't it?
The chart showed no expenses. But
no production.
And no production. That's correct. But the question of, but that really goes to the point of materiality.
Well, let's go back to the representation, because in the petitioner's brief, they say that as part of the bid process, your client had to sign a document saying that there are no warranties at all regarding title, and then specifically in the document that you got, it said, yes, we're conveying our right, title, and interest without warranty of title, either expressed or implied. Now, doesn't that tell you that you're taking it with the knowledge that you may not have title?
No, it doesn't. In this particular instance, it doesn't absolve this party from violations of the Texas Securities Act, because they made a misrepresentation that there was a lease. Aside from the fact that they said that you're taking it without title. They represented that there was a lease. They provided us with lease files that said there was a lease and that showed that they owned a working interest.
Well, there was a lease.
Well, yes, at one time, but it had terminated a year prior to that, and that information could not be generated or could not be learned from the lease file.
Can the state waive that? I mean, they were, as I understand it, they were shutting it in, hoping the pressure would build back up. If it did, and the state said, fine, keep going, we don't want to rebid this thing, is there some reason the state couldn't have done that?
Well, from a technical standpoint, no. Under the Jupiter Oil versus Snow case, once the lease is terminated, the fee simple determinable interest reverts back to the state, so they would have had to execute a brand new lease in order for that to be valid, or at least what's typical, a modification or an amendment to it, to show that the lease, though it may have terminated, was now an alive and well lease for the state.
What if this had been a corporate acquisition and this was a piece? There was a piece of property, a real surface property that the corporation has. You know, I'm conveying you these 10 properties with this same language, right title interest, without warranty of title, either express or implied. It turns out that 10 years ago, somebody got adverse limitations on this on one of the pieces of property, and they didn't own it. Now, is that a Securities Act violation?
If it's a non-operating working interest,
I'm talking about
just an oil and gas interest.
Black acre, not oil and gas interest, a surface land.
I don't believe. I'm sorry.
What's the difference?
I don't believe that's a security.
Well, they're buying the stock of a company and they list their assets for, and they said we don't. But the instrument says you get our right title and interest to these properties, but without warranty of title, either express or implied. Now, is that a security?
I would suggest to you that it is a security, and that's a possible securities violation depending upon the totality of the circumstances surrounding that transaction, which is what all the federal courts say, how you interpret whether a misrepresentation rises to the level of being material.
What's the policy behind that, the disclosure?
The policy behind it is to protect investors. And this court, in 1971, said, and you're supposed to give we're to give this statute the widest possible scope for the purpose of protecting investors and for the purpose of having full disclosure.
But if the investor signs something, he says, I know that I may not be getting title, and the document transferring it says, I know I may not be getting title, and the documentation that goes with the transfer shows that there was no production for a year and no working expenses done for a year, and you can look at the terms of the lease and see, we got a problem here. How is that a misrepresentation?
It's a misrepresentation. Those types of that coupled with the fact that there were statements that there was. I mean, you have to. If you take that into the abstract, you just can't do that. You have to take that into consideration with all of the facts.
What other facts are there?
Well, the facts are that they sent us a brochure that said they're selling, that there's a lease, and that they're selling.
Yeah, here's the lease. Here's the terms, and it will terminate if this, and this happens. And they sent you, and there was also a chart that said this, and this happened.
No, that chart didn't. I disagree with that. That evidence, that's a mischaracterization of the evidence. There's a column in a chart which, without any backup documentation, how do you know what it means or doesn't mean? The point here is there was backup documentation that should have been supplied that wasn't supplied.
What would that have shown that was not on the chart?
Well, what it would have shown was that there was some activity on the well. That activity was simply the dropping of a string line down in to see if there was blockage. There was some activity that it would have shown exactly when the activity stopped, and it would have shown when the lease had terminated.
Well, why does that matter if the chart you have just showed no production? And I mean, if there's no production after 60 days, doesn't it lapse?
Under this particular lease, if there was no production or no continuous operations or reworking operations.
And you could see, based on the length of time under the chart, that there were not.
Well, if your chart's accurate, then that would be true. You would show this.
Are you contending the chart wasn't accurate?
I'm not making that contention at all. But the point I am trying to make, though, is that if you can't, that would be trying to say, as a matter of law, the materiality is rebutted. And the cases under the Federal Act and the cases under all the Uniform Acts says you can't rebut materiality as a matter of law.
So you're just saying you can't quit claim under the Texas Securities Act. You just can't do it. If you purport to own something, say, I don't know if I own it or not, I quit claim it, you got a securities violation.
If you make a statement, if you make an affirmative statement and disclose that this lease may have terminated, then you probably have a strong defense that there's not materiality.
I don't understand the difference between that language and when I sign something, say I may not have title, I may not have marketable title, the seller's not warranting title, either express or implied. I don't understand the the difference between the two.
Okay. Well, the difference is such disclaimers go to the issue of materiality. And one of the interesting things about this case is I did not see a single citation from my opponent concerning disclaimers and from the various states or the federal courts related to disclaimers such as the one that you're talking about. But I did find a case, and it's also cited in the amicus brief, in which the district court up in Pennsylvania, In re Farmore, dealt with a disclaimer not unlike what Your Honor is discussing. It says, I'm not making any representations to you at all. You're doing your own homework here. And the In re Farmore case said, under Section 12.2 of the 1933 Act, that goes to the issue of materiality. It does not get you out of out of liability under the federal act. And there's a strong policy reason for that, and it's actually in the statute. In the statute itself, there's an anti-waiver provision. Now, I know we've dealt with anti-waiver provisions, and actually the federal courts call it an anticipatory waiver provision. But the Texas Act has the identical language, virtually identical language, that is, to the federal act, which says a condition stipulation provision binding a seller of a security to waive compliance with the provision of this act or rule or order or requirement here under is void. Now, the federal courts have interpreted that particular statute in four separate cases. Unfortunately, none of these are cited to the court. I found them Tuesday. I provided my opposing counsel with copies or the citations to these, but I direct the court's attention to the case of AES Corp. versus Dow Chemical. It's the Third Circuit case, 325 F3rd 174. Also, King versus Allied Vision, which can be found at 65 F3rd 1051. Citibank versus Ichicho, which can be found at 2003 Westlaw 1797-84-7. And MBI Acquisition, which can be found at 2001 Westlaw 1478-81-2. I'd like, in those cases, hold that a clause in a contract that attempts to negate an element of the plaintiff's security cause of action and thus its substantive rights is in violation of the federal anti-waiver statute.
But this is something, this is the whole point of this auction is to engage in this gambling, it seems to me. I can understand that the federal and state securities laws may have some interest in precluding one-on-one transactions or those kinds of contracts in consumer situations or something like that. But where sophisticated oil and gas men get together to play blackjack, it looks to me like we should let them play.
Well, Your Honor, if that's the case, then the statute doesn't make that distinction. That's the problem that Your Honor is articulating. It seems like we ought to let them play, but the statute doesn't make the distinction if it's sold at an auction or an estate sale or between an arm's length negotiated transaction.
And I guess it's true here. There's never been a complaint that he didn't get $300 worth of stuff. The complaint is that he bought a big liability, may have bought a big liability that he wished he didn't have.
That's exactly what spawned this lawsuit, Your Honor, that a liability.
But your client knew that if wells sometimes get shut in, even if they only paid $300, if they had to pay their share of shut-in costs, it could be a bunch. You knew that without being told.
Well, in the oil and gas business, you know that.
Everybody knows.
Certainly.
And, if they'd have paid $1 for this, there would have been no question they weren't thinking they were getting much of a lease, right?
Your Honor, I would submit to you that it doesn't matter whether they paid a penny for it. If it's a security and there was consideration paid, it wouldn't matter if they paid 25 cents because the Securities Act doesn't make those types of distinctions.
I still have a problem with your waiver argument. To me, I'm just having difficulty seeing how this is a waiver because to me it goes to whether there's a misrepresentation or not. You say, I don't know if I have time or not. I'm offering this to you for whatever you want to pay for it. I put it in the auction and if it's off for a dollar, that's it. I've agreed to put it in there. But I've said, I don't know if I own title or not. I'm not warranting title. You pay for whatever.
Here's the distinction, Your Honor. Maybe, and I've tried to answer, and I guess I haven't been clear, so let me try it again. The point is not whether they've sold us title. We wouldn't even be in there bidding on this property if there hadn't been representation that there was a lease. The point about the quit claim is it's a complete red herring. The issue is there was a misrepresentation or an omission that there was a lease when the reality was there wasn't.
Here's my interest. Here's the document I signed. I may or may not have an interest. I'm not warranting what my interest is. Here it is. Take it. Do your own investigation and decide what you want to bid on.
Well, Your Honor, I would submit to you that in the federal system, under the identical federal statutes, that goes to the materiality of whether the representation related to the lease versus whether there's a quit claim goes to the question of materiality. And, in fact, I will tell you, that was tried. That very issue was tried to the jury in this case. They argued it. Not ad nauseum, because I'm good friends with my colleagues here, but they argued it extensively. They cross-examined my client extensively concerning that very issue, and the jury had those facts before it in the totality of the circumstances. What the cases are holding is that you just can't take a set of facts, hold it out in isolation, and say that automatically rebuts the securities cause of action.
I think what you're doing is holding out in isolation that there was, quote, a representation that there was a lease. I mean, the representation was, I signed this, here's all the stuff about it. I may or may not have title. I may or may not have this interest. You make your own.
I'm not holding that out in isolation at all. I'm actually saying that you take all of these factors into consideration and you take into consideration the evidence that was presented to the jury and let the jury decide about materiality. That's also the other point. Materiality is a fact question.
What effect will this holding have on the auction?
I don't believe it will have any effect whatsoever.
None. I mean, non-operating, there's a lot of things non-operating working interest owners don't know about that.
That's true.
And so a lot of non-operating, apparently 20,000 of them, non-operating working interest owners want to sell their working interest, right?
I would imagine at some point that's true.
So the deal is they're going to have to do an exhaustive examination, find out just as much as the operator knows before they can get out of it, even if they're only selling it for $300.
I think the only thing that they have to do is act. The statute gives them a defense. The defense is, well, two defenses. One, I actually knew that what you said was false. Or two, you acted reasonably and prudently. And despite your actions of being reasonable and prudent, you were unable to learn the
lesson. And in hindsight, more often than not, a jury's going to say you should have found out what they found out later.
Well, actually, in this particular instance.
Or if I can rephrase it slightly, if a jury might find that out, you're going to have to go to trial, and this one thing you want to unload for $300 is going to cost you at least $100,000 in attorney's fees.
Your Honor, that is
certainly going to have some effect on the auction.
It will have an effect from the standpoint that you're going to have to be careful about what you put up for auction, and you're going to have to be careful about what you say. I mean,
when you say be careful, that means you're going to have to spend money.
You're going to have to spend a little bit more money. You know, but let's not feel too sorry for Geodyne. They did get some money out of this well before it sputtered out. You know, this well wasn't a big producer, but the facts of the case were that there was $500,000 or more of revenue generated by this well. So,
And then unloaded the liability.
And then unloaded the liability. That's exactly what happened.
Going back to misrepresentation, one more. I really want you to help me here. Your client also signed a document that said, I've got 90 days to figure out if I have title. Because it contemplated voiding the sale and returning your $300. If within 90 days it was determined that you didn't get conveyed to you what you thought you got. Now, isn't that another indication that this is not a misrepresentation, that you are buying something not knowing whether you're going to get any title or not?
Actually, what the document says, if I may, it says that if the interests conveyed are different than what is on the document, you got 90 days to let us know that the interests are different. In other words, if there was a 10% interest in this instance, as we all know, working interest can be very small fractional shares. If it turns out that that is a different fractional share, then you come back to me and you let me know that. The facts of this case are that when we thought we purchased this, we immediately sent a division order to the operator. And we didn't hear back from the operator until July, when the operator sent us a bill saying, pay us $75,000.
I'm just saying the document you signed contemplated that you might not get anything because it was either you're going to ratchet down pro rata, or if you own nothing, your whole thing was going to be called off voided, is what the language says, and you get your money back. So I mean, it seems to me there was a contemplation from the get go that you might be buying nothing at all.
One thing I need to point out on that, Your Honor, is. And this kind of goes to the Prudential versus Jefferson Associates case that's cited quite a bit in both briefs. And that is, those are adhesion terms. Those are non-negotiable terms. That's another point that needs to be made, is when you walk into the auction, before you walk into the auction, you go to the door, they give you a form contract or this form that has boilerplate provisions on it that where you have to agree to all of these things before you can even go in and try to participate in the auction. As Justice Heck wrote in Prudential, you know, while that may be okay, there shouldn't be a problem if you've got an arm's length negotiated deal, but then you've got...
The U.S. Supreme Court has come out differently on that. Even in the Carnival Cruise Lines ticket, it was boilerplate language on their ticket that they had to bring a lawsuit in Florida, and the U.S. Supreme Court said there's nothing unconscionable or enforceable or anything wrong with that, so I'm not sure...
Well, but the point here, though, is whether you can waive elements of a securities cause of action
It goes to me whether there's even a misrepresentation from the get-go. That's where I'm having the difficulty. Because it seems like you were being told, your client was, from every step of the way, you may be buying a pig in the poke. You may be buying nothing. If that happens, you've got 9 days to figure it out and get your money back.
Your Honor, I submit to you that the only place that those statements were made is in these adhesion form contracts. If someone had come in and said, I'm not going, if they had said or put something outside of one of these boilerplate provisions, they put something outside that says, you know, we are telling you that this lease may have terminated, I would agree with you that there wasn't a misrepresentation. But that didn't happen. What the Geodyne is arguing is I can throw all of this stuff.
But you could see that the lease may have terminated. Couldn't you see from the lack of production that it may have terminated?
Well, the point, though, is whether I actually knew that it had terminated. That's the issue. It's not a defense that I might have known, and I don't believe, I mean, in this particular instance, I don't believe that's what the evidence, that is what the evidence shows. The only defense that they have is that I actually knew. You can't apply constructive knowledge under the Texas Securities Act or under the federal act. I see that I'm out of time now.
Well, we were asking questions. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, let's talk for just a minute about oil and gas auctions. This is not the only place where you can buy oil and gas properties. In fact, it's probably one of the worst places that you can buy oil and gas properties. As a friend of mine often says to me, everyone in the industry knows that the oil and gas auctions sell ash and trash. And so it will definitely have an effect on auctions to do what Newton wants here. I was looking through the exhibits last night, and our Exhibit 11, which is in Volume 9, has one page of the auction brochure. And it has about 48 properties listed on that single page. I counted 7 as having no production whatsoever. So this is a very common thing.
But isn't the auction also going to be hurt? Everybody knows this is the place where you go when the lease lapses and you're about to get a joint interest billing for the close-in costs. And so everybody knows that's mostly the stuff that's being sold at the auction. It's going to be hurt then too, right?
Well, that has been true up until now, and there's been a very much of a thriving auction industry. I'm not saying all these properties sell. There was one bidder on this property, and it was Newton, and no one else even bid. And Newton didn't have to bid $300. It could have
been. But should we be running an auction that's selling off my statutory, nothing probably, but my statutory liability to cap the well?
Well, hopefully what's happening
is
that people are coming in after signing these forms, and they are only bidding on properties where they have a pretty good clue as to what they're going to do with it. Maybe they know somebody at the GLO. Maybe they know that they can get an extension of a lease or a renewal of a lease or that they can package it up and do something with it. Hopefully they're not just wandering in and buying a well that's been dead for 6 months and just hoping against hope that something will happen to revive it. Although, actually, in this situation, the operator was trying to do that very thing, And no one knew until about 3 months after the auction that the thing was really dead, because the operator was even preparing in September of that year. The operator prepared an authorization for expenditure to do a workover.
Do you agree, incidentally, with the respondent's position that the lessor cannot waive the termination of the lease for non-production or not? If the lease terminates for non-production, can the lessor waive that or not?
I don't see how that's a waiver point. I mean, it seems to me that the lessor can waive it. There are various ways that the lessor can ratify adverse possession. This court has even approved of. They can revive the lease. Yes, they absolutely, I think, can breathe new life into that lease.
Because there was some indication in this record that they've been in contact with the state and maybe the GLO was okay with this or
yes.
Some sort of loose language.
Yes, they could have signed something, and it just would not have been an issue. Let me talk for a second about the case that they just cited, I think, the AES Corp case. I'll send a citation, but it's 325 F3rd 174. It's the Third Circuit case. And there are a number of cases out of the First, Second, and Third Circuits that deal with promises that you're not relying, promises that there's no representation, no warranty, that type of thing. The courts have dealt with it somewhat differently. No court simply ignores those things. They are not just removed from the formula. The Second Circuit basically enforced it. And in a security setting. The Third Circuit and the First Circuit say we don't just automatically enforce these things. We look at them as one factor as to the person's behavior and what they would have relied upon and whether there was causation and whatnot. They say that it may establish an absence of reliance and when unrebutted may even provide a basis for summary judgment in the defendant's favor. That's the Third Circuit. It's very much that the courts take very much the same approach that this court took in Prudential. It's not always given absolute credence across the board. You look at it in the context of what happened, but if everything that happened was okay, then it gets the court will pay attention to it. I see my time is up. I received the amicus brief late last week, and we would like to send in something to help the court pick through that brief and hear the same.
I think we'd also appreciate additional briefing from both sides on the federal cases that you cited verbally today.
Yes, we will. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you. Court will take another brief recess.